Well, it's great to see so many people here. I know that for many of you it's exam time, and it's all to your credit that you've come. This evening will, however, deal with something of incredible contemporary relevance. You will have seen that we're talking about military and security companies operating in situations of armed conflict, and we have a panel of speakers who have different perspectives to bring to bear on the topic, and we're delighted to be doing this event, as we've done now for a number of years, in collaboration with the International Committee of the Red Cross. I do have a piece of information which is modestly regrettable, which is that we won't be joined by Andrew Gilligan. Andrew, we've just spoken to, and he had formed the clear view that he was to come to the LSE tomorrow. And had we not alerted him to this, he would have regarded the event as poorly attended, and he might well have found himself addressing a student group on something quite different. So, regrettably, Andrew Gilligan won't be here. But we do have a casting which I'm pretty confident can cover the ground that we intended to cover, and we also have, of course, an audience which, in true LSE style, reflects a very great amount of hands-on experience as well, and we have an extensive period of question and answer afterwards. I'll introduce each person now, briefly, and they will then be able to speak. The first speaker will be a great friend of the centre and colleague, and the kind of person who, when you hear that the speaker who was to have made the first contribution isn't here, you turn to and say, it's your turn to go first, and that is Chiloka Biani, who is senior lecturer here and has been a lecturer at LSE since 1996. His research interests, as are well known, he's spoken at the centre before, are in the field of international law and human rights and various other matters, and he has a particular interest and specialism in the legal aspects of mercenaries, the regulation of private military companies, and state and other actors' responsibilities for human rights. So we look to Chiloka Biani to kick us off. And we then have, reflecting the Red Cross involvement in the evening, we have, I'm delighted to say, Emmanuela Gillard, who's legal advisor at the legal division of the International Committee of the Red Cross, a great friend of the centres, and has contributed on past occasions to this event. Emmanuel's particular engagement across the Red Cross include, of course, many things, but perhaps relevant is to say that she spent several months in Iraq and has been a legal advisor to the Red Cross operations there, and has a particular specialism in private military companies. So we'll be able to report, as it were, from that particular front line. Andy Bearpark, our final speaker, we're delighted to have to the centre, possibly under your first visit to the centre. Mm-hmm. And he's the currently Director General of the British Association of Private Security Companies. He's an advisor to governments, international organisations, the commercial sector and so on. And relevantly, among his many other jobs in the past, Andy has been Director of Operations and Infrastructure for the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, and he's also served as UN Deputy Special Representative of the Secretary General and UN EU Representative, rather, with responsibility for economic development in Kosovo. He's worked in Bosnia as well, and previously Press Secretary to Minister Baroness Chalker. So we've got somebody with strong political involvement, Red Cross involvement, and legal involvement to tackle what I think is coming to be understood to be an issue of extraordinary importance and one that cries out for the kind of critical engagement that an event like this can bring. And I think that's reflected in the numbers present both here and upstairs. We've asked our speakers to speak for 10 to 15 minutes. The absence of Andrew means that they've each been able to secure an extra 4 1/4 minutes. We are, as those of us who've been at these events before know, extremely strict on timing at the Centre for the Study of Human Rights, which includes a guaranteed end to the evening. followed by drinks. As is the tradition, I do not reveal where the drinks are. We change the location to fool those who leave early in search of an early drink, but we will reveal all later after we've told you about certain book deals that can be done as you leave the theatre. However, without further ado, I'm delighted to invite Chiloka Biani to kick us off this evening.
Thank you very much, Connor, for that kind introduction. I think the discussion tonight covers a subject which is growing in almost every respect. And it's also a subject whereby both professional military interests, the human rights, international humanitarian law, seem to merge. My role is essentially to cover the transition from mercenaries to private military companies, leaving aside the aspects of international humanitarian law to Manu, since international humanitarian law safeguards its terrain so jealously and resists an intrusion by human rights. And I'll try and keep to that specific profile. No specific definition of a mercenary. However, a mercenary is a person commonly perceived as a foreign national fighting for private gain and who is motivated by such vein. And according to old adage, a mercenary is a person who deserves to be shot on sight unless they had a bloody good lawyer with them. Human rights, however, is such that the prohibition on the intentional deprivation of the right to life or arbitrary deprivation of life would protect mercenaries. But how did we come to this? Mercenaries have long been part of armed conflict since 334 BC in the Greek days. The support of Greek mercenaries to those who were fighting in the Persian Gulf. But more recently, the subject came to light in the context of self-determination and independence, particularly in Africa. And I intend to focus on the UN Convention on the prohibition against the recruitment, use, financing, and training of mercenaries, and the African Union Convention on the Elimination of Mercenaries, 1977. Both conventions are now in force. Both were motivated by the fact that, first of all, in 1960, there was a particularly sad episode in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, when shortly after independence, the Katangese people in southern Congo rebelled against Mobutu. Mobutu then employed Belgian mercenaries to put down the rebellion. And since that time, mercenaries became an important flashpoint in Africa. The Congolese episode was followed by American and British mercenaries in Angola fighting against the MPLA. And more recently, in 2004, we saw how a group of mercenaries running from South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Equatorial Guinea attempted to overthrow the government of Equatorial Guinea. So both these episodes obviously show that both the old and new mercenaries are alive. But what do the conventions say about mercenaries? First of all, the Convention Against the Recruitment, Use, and Financing and Training of Mercenaries prohibits those activities and seeks to establish any act of recruitment, use, financing, and training of mercenaries as a criminal act. It also prohibits participation in hostilities involving mercenaries. And above all, it establishes universal jurisdiction to punish or extradite offenders. However, the scope is limited. It is limited to the country where the mercenary activity has taken place. The focus is not on the nature and purpose of the unlawful activity of mercenarism as such. It has no monitoring mechanism to ensure compliance. And it's tied down to the nationality requirements, which pose problems for those who wish to abuse and circumvent the requirement or the quintessential aspect of a mercenary as a foreign national, because you can hire nationals indirectly and use them to fight against their own governments. So these aspects were considered by a group of experts of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and I served on that group for 3 years and later became a chairperson of the group. And what that group thought would be wise would be to expand the definition of a mercenary so that it does include legal persons and draws a distinction between traditional mercenaries and private military companies, that a monitoring body be established under that convention, under the auspices of ECOSOC, the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations, or failing that, at least submitting to treaty body processes, especially Article 1 of both covenants, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, since on the agenda of the Human Rights Commission, the item on mercenaries has always appeared under the theme self-determination of peoples and independence. There'll be more of that aspect coming towards the end, but it's quite clear that that convention does not cover private military companies. The African Convention in 1977 entered into force and was drafted before the UN Convention and is somewhat more precise in the sense that it goes beyond recruiting, financing, and the use of mercenaries. It covers the offense of mercenarism, that is, a focus on what a mercenary is actually hired to do and not who a mercenary is by virtue of the definition contained in international humanitarian law. It establishes jurisdiction on the part of member states to punish mercenaries. However, it also has its own weaknesses, the major one of which is that it establishes the crime of mercenarism by reference to opposing the process of self-determination. And that's a huge problem, given that self-determination and its content is also a fluid concept. Besides that, it ignores the problem that, as Mobutu did, African states actually routinely recruit mercenaries in order to fight their own people. And those fights or wars may involve legitimate aspirations to national self-determination on the part of the people. It does not have universal jurisdiction, and therefore, in that sense, it is limited. It has not been enforced by African states, nor any African state that I know of, despite the fact that mercenarism in Africa has been a feature since independence. From mercenaries then to private military companies, and private military companies are distinguished from individual mercenaries in the sense that these are smart corporate bodies offering a diverse range of services from military advice and training to arms procurement, intelligence gathering, logistical, medical support, as well as combat and operational support. And the industry now benefits from some $30 billion each year. So it is a huge industry. The companies also have a long history that is associated with military ties. And in the United Kingdom in particular, it's associated with the Special Air Services, SAS, from the Second World War. And most of the persons who have gone on to establish private military companies are former members of the SAS. In the United States, private military companies were always part of the military structure in the sense that they're incorporated to provide certain logistical and military support. But three key episodes, I think, have become important in this regard. The first is the security sector reform in the 1990s, which, along with a wave of privatization, saw the downsizing of state armies and reform of military services, and persons who were former military personnel forming companies in order to provide special services in that particular regard. Most of these were professional military companies such as Military Professional Resources in the US, Dyn Corporation and Halliburton, specialized roles in training as well as providing logistical support. A second dimension was the establishment of these companies in Africa, such as Executive Outcomes and Sandline International, which went beyond the traditional mode of a private military company, in the sense that they were actually involved in combat rather than just operational support, and recruited around 1,000 soldiers who had the capacity to fight on the front and were involved in fighting in Angola, Sierra Leone, and other places. And it is these aspects that have caused significant problems on what do we do with the proliferation of private military companies. As we speak, in Iraq, there are more than 10,000 individuals employed by private military companies as well as private security companies. They're outside the traditional definition of a mercenary, yet in certain respects, they do recruit mercenaries. And in other respects, the line is very thin. Some of the people involved in attempting to overthrow the government of Equatorial Guinea had been executive directors of private military companies, and yet in that episode, they were clearly in the traditional role of a mercenary, which means that the dividing lines are always shifting depending on who is acting and who is doing what. There are also important aspects to consider, especially in the context of extraterritorial responsibility for violations of human rights. The old mercenary legislation, such as the Foreign Enlistment Act, 1870 of the United Kingdom, was concerned to preserve the neutrality of the state and therefore not engage its responsibility for acts of mercenaries abroad. In the context of private military companies, no such legislation actually exists to preserve the neutrality of the state, and concerns do arise about how states may actually be held responsible for the acts of companies incorporated in their territories when those companies violate human rights abroad. And since companies cannot be sued before human rights bodies, it is feasible that the state of incorporation may actually be sued under appropriate treaties as well as fora. And that particular aspect, I think, has led to the clamor for looking at ways of either regulating private military companies. We can't prohibit them because they enjoy freedom of association under human rights. They exercise legitimate corporate identity as corporate bodies, they're legal persons. And therefore, attention has to tilt elsewhere. What is, I think, favored by the companies is self-regulation, i.e. a code of ethics and conduct adhered to them by them and run by their own command structures. This does not prevent abuse. The next line is to consider amendments to the 1989 Convention, and the group of experts did consider that, first of all, it might be useful to include legal persons in the definition of mercenaries and expand the definition so that it captures the phenomenon of private military companies. The prohibition of private military companies in direct participation in armed conflict. The ICRC is currently looking at what direct participation actually means. Prohibiting PMCs from recruiting mercenaries. In Colombia, it is fairly well known, for example, that Defense Systems International Incorporation has recruited individual mercenaries as part of its personnel, or prohibit mercenaries from illegal extraction of natural resources. And we saw in Sierra Leone how the president of Ahmed Kaba failing to pay a private military company, Executive Outcomes and Sunderland in this case, actually gave them concessions to mine diamonds instead, which leads to other problems about the permanent sovereignty over natural resources. Others favor national legislation as a method for doing this, and to date, only South Africa's Foreign Military Assistance Act exists as a model of legislation which regulates the existence of private military companies and makes a distinction between traditional military activity and legitimate provision of military services. New Zealand, which passed legislation on mercenaries in 2004, however, has not extended its legislation to private military companies. In the United States, regulation is mostly through arms exports controls, a system of licensing about who acquires arms and who sells them where and who is engaged in what activity. The final aspect of regulation in the U.S. is on police guidelines governing contractors in combat zones, such as Iraq, and this policy is under review at the moment. It doesn't have a legislative base, but it provides an administrative framework for looking at the activities of private military companies. And with that, I think I will end and give room for questions towards the end. Thank you.
Rather spookily, that was 14 and a half minutes exactly, which is pretty stunning. Thank you very much. Chiloka covered an amazing amount of ground, which, as you rightly say, can be developed in the question and answers later.
I plan to stick to time in my old age.
That's another 5 seconds, which takes you over time. Emanuela.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to address the international humanitarian law dimension, not because I don't want to touch human rights law, but because it's a lot easier. As Chiloka has pointed out, there's a lot of interest in these new actors. But are they really new? Probably not. What is new are two features. First, the numbers. And Chiloka has given us an indication in the context of Iraq, both in terms of numbers of staff and also in terms of dollar amounts. Question mark whether Iraq is in fact representative of things to come. The second thing that's different is the nature of the activities carried out by these companies. Traditionally, they have tended to provide logistical support and those kinds of activities very much in the rear of the action. What is new is that they have come increasingly close to the heart of military operations. In practical terms, definitely from the point of view of the ICRC's interest in them, this means that they often come in direct contact with persons protected by international humanitarian law, be they civilians, particularly in situations of occupations, or persons deprived of their liberty. In view of this new reality, the International Committee of the Red Cross, already in 2004, initiated a dialogue with the companies and also with states that have responsibilities for them. And as Chiloga has pointed out, these could be the states that hire them, but it's not limited to that. The states where the companies are incorporated also have a role to play, as do the states where the companies are operating. The aim of this dialogue was twofold. First, we wanted to ensure that everyone, states and private military companies, private security companies, were aware of the fact that they had responsibilities under international humanitarian law. And secondly, at a much more operational level, we wanted to make sure that the companies themselves were aware of the International Committee of the Red Cross, of its mandate and of its activities. Why is this important? I always give a very practical scenario. In Iraq, the outermost checkpoints for prisoners of war camps are staffed by private military companies, private security companies. We have to go through, and we want to make sure that they know that we have a right to visit these places, because the outermost checkpoint of a prisoner of war camp in Iraq is one of the last places you want to get stuck at. So this very operational dimension. I propose to only focus on the legal dimension, the legal framework. And it's often said that there is a vacuum in the law when it comes to private military, private security companies. They have no status under international law, there is no body of law that governs their activities, and there is no accountability for any violations they commit. If they are operating in a situation of armed conflict, this is not, in fact, correct. There is a specific body of law, international humanitarian law, that regulates the status of the staff of the companies. It lays down very clear obligations, but also protections with regard to how they must operate. There's also a body of law that regulates the responsibilities of states that hire private military companies, and we mustn't forget the state dimension of the discussion. And the criminal responsibility of individual staff members who commit serious violations of IHL is also well established and exists. Where there is very little national law and no international law is at a rather different level, and it is at the level of regulation to determine in what circumstances a company may be allowed to provide services abroad, in what instances can it be granted an operating license to carry out what kind of activities, what criteria must it satisfy. Similarly, there's very little at the national level. As Chiloka pointed out, in terms of regulatory framework for companies operating abroad, we currently only have South Africa by means of the Foreign Military Assistance Act. The UK was at one point considering adopting similar legislation. In terms of the territorial state, at present it is only Sierra Leone and Iraq that have any national legislation laying down the conditions that company must meet in order to be allowed to operate there. I'm very conscious of time, so I'm only going to touch upon some of these very important issues, but I'm happy to discuss other ones later. So first, and inevitably simplifying things a lot, what about the status? Well, first and foremost, the companies themselves don't have a status under international humanitarian law. That's just because international humanitarian law does not address juridical people. It only focuses on states, organized armed groups, and individuals. However, the staff of private security companies do. Unfortunately, there is no single simple answer as to their status. It depends on a case-by-case basis on who is hiring the company. Is it a state? Is it someone else? And also, if it is a state that hires them, on the relationship between the staff of the company and the state itself. I'll come to this in a second. However, within international humanitarian law, we do find criteria for determining what the status is, and also consequent rights and obligations depending on the status. So what can the possible status under international humanitarian law be? It's only one of two possibilities. They're either combatants or civilians. And we've got to take a step back here and realize that the term combatant is a term of art in international humanitarian law and means something much more specific than fighters. And I'm flagging this because I'm going to say something that is going to be rather counterintuitive to you, but then you'll understand why. So who is a combatant within this special meaning under international humanitarian law? It is only the members of the armed forces of a state who can be combatants. What is the consequence of being a combatant under international humanitarian law? Such a person, i.e. a soldier, is entitled to fight, can be targeted, and if captured, is entitled to prisoner of war status, so protection under the Third Geneva Convention, and also they cannot be tried merely for taking direct part in hostilities. That's what combatants means. You have a right to fight. So where does this leave us with the staff of private military companies, private security companies? Well, first and foremost, as we've said, that it is only the members of the armed forces of a state who can possibly be combatants. They could possibly be combatants only if they are hired by a state. And the reality is that while states do hire a number of companies, there are lots of other bodies that are also hiring private security in situations of armed conflict, intergovernmental organizations, non-governmental organizations, private companies, and also rebel groups. If a PMC, PSC is hired by them, there is no way, as a matter of law, that their staff can be combatants. Additionally, it's not sufficient that a state hires the PMC for their staff automatically to be combatants. They need to form part of the armed forces of the state. They need to be incorporated. There is no clear test for determining what amounts to incorporation, but if one looks back at the thinking underlying much of the outsourcing, it is unlikely that the staff of PMCs is incorporated into the armed forces to the extent necessary for them to be considered combatants. So on the whole, I would say that it'd be very rare for the members of PMCs, PSCs, to be considered combatants. What does this mean in practice? And this is what's going to surprise you. Well, if they're not combatants, they must be civilians. And this is very counterintuitive because the image we have of the staff of private military security companies is someone in uniform, carrying heavy weapons, carrying out all kinds of activities that to us seem very closely related to the armed conflict. Wait a minute. What does it mean to be a civilian? A civilian must not be targeted. However, they lose this protection from attack if they carry out activities that amount to taking direct part in hostilities. So in practical terms, again, something that needs to be determined on a case-by-case basis, some of these people that we see in uniform carrying weapons may be carrying out activities that amount to taking direct part in hostilities. What amounts to that is not easy to determine, and therefore lose their protection against attack and can be targeted while they're carrying out these activities. What else? Well, if they are captured, as they're not members of the armed forces of a state, they're not entitled to prisoner of war status. So they're not entitled to protection under the Third Geneva Convention and can be tried merely for having taken direct part, even if they don't violate international humanitarian law. This does not mean that they're without protections, because if they're not protected under the Third Geneva Convention, they are protected under the Fourth Geneva Conventions as civilians who have taken direct part in hostilities and have important protections in relation to deprivation of liberty. And most importantly, be they combatants, be they civilians, like anyone else in a situation of armed conflict, the staff of private security, private military companies must respect international humanitarian law in the conduct of hostilities and in terms, for example, of the rights of persons deprived of their liberty with whom they come into contact. So they are bound by international humanitarian law and face individual criminal responsibilities if they commit serious violations, war crimes. And this is something very important to bear in mind when we hear there is no body of law to hold them accountable. Yes, there is. Under the Geneva Conventions, all 193 state parties have an obligation to search for and prosecute persons suspected of grave breaches, including by the application of extraterritorial jurisdiction. So there is a very firm foundation. In practical terms, we have seen very few prosecutions. Why? And this isn't something that's specific to PMCs, but generally, for a variety of reasons. They might have been given immunity from local process. This is, in fact, what happened in Iraq. Under order CPA Order 17, contractors were given immunity from the local criminal courts. The local criminal courts might not be functioning because they're operating in a situation of armed conflict. Third states might be reluctant for political or practical reasons to bring extraterritorial proceedings. This is something we see in general in relation to war crimes and not specifically to private military, private security companies. Let's move away briefly from the individuals and look at the companies. As I've said, taking a rather traditional approach, companies don't have direct obligations and rights under international humanitarian law, but they can take certain measures to ensure respect for the law by their staff. And I'm just going to flag this because I'm sure Andy will talk about this, but definitely issues that the ICRC has identified, steps that can be usefully taken, relate to vetting of staff, make sure you don't hire anyone with a bad record in terms of human rights, IHL violations, training in international humanitarian law. It's not sufficient to say these people in their previous lives as members of the armed forces were trained. Now they're carrying out a very different role. They're no longer members of the armed forces. So we insist in situation and context and task-specific training. They need to be provided standard operating procedures, rules of engagement that comply with international humanitarian law, and any allegations of wrongdoing must be investigated by the company and communicated to the responsible authorities. Very briefly, what about the responsibility of states? And this is something we shouldn't forget because there's a tendency to focus just on the responsibilities of the companies and their staff. Well, obviously, clearly, obviously the state that hires private military, private security companies has got some very clear and direct obligations. First, they can't absolve themselves of their own obligations under international humanitarian law by hiring a company to carry out the tasks. If you hire a company to run a prisoner of war camp, you, the state, must still meet the obligations under the Third Geneva Convention. They've got to ensure respect for international humanitarian law by these companies. We can discuss possible measures later. They may face responsibility for acts that are attributable to them, committed by the companies, by the staff of the companies. It's just may, because it's not automatic, and I guidance on the types of activities that would give rise to state responsibility can be obtained from the ILC draft articles on state responsibilities. And then, this is a point I made earlier, all states are under an obligation to search for and prosecute persons suspected of grave breaches of international humanitarian law. Obviously, this obligation applies a fortiori if it is persons that you yourself have hired who are suspected of violations. That's the state that hires the PMC, but the private company. What about other states? And while their responsibilities or possibly their role to play in ensuring respect for the law is not so clear-cut, there is a potential for other states to do something to promote respect. And I'm thinking particularly on the provision in Article 1, common to the Four Geneva Conventions, that calls on all states to respect international humanitarian law and to ensure respect for international humanitarian law. And I think that on the basis of these obligations, some states are in a particularly good position to promote respect. And I'm thinking particularly of the states where the companies operate and also the states where the companies are incorporated. They might take measures at the national level, possibly by means of regulatory framework, that would promote respect for international humanitarian law and also address a number of the other issues that have been raised by these new actors that we haven't touched upon now in terms, for example, of oversight, accountability, promotion of foreign policy. This could also be addressed by means of a regulatory framework. I'm going to stop here, but perhaps during the question and answer sessions, I could briefly present an intergovernmental initiative that has been launched by the Swiss Ministry of Foreign Affairs in close cooperation with the ICRC, addressed to governments to encourage them to take steps to promote respect for international humanitarian law.
Thank you, I mean, so much for such a clear exposition. And let's hope you get a question about Swiss intergovernmental initiatives. So then you can expostulate on what you plan to say. But I'm sure you can twist a question in that direction. So we look forward to that. We look forward to that. And now we have Andy. Without further ado, I think, Andy, the floor is yours.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And what our chairman didn't tell you is that Manu ran over time. I am going to go for the sympathy vote. I will go under time to bring us back on target for the drinks. So I thought that'll help me, you see, because I'm the hate figure from the PSCs. Anyway, enough of this nonsense of theory. Let's start dealing with reality. And there are just three areas that I'd like to cover. The first one is, what are we talking about? Are we talking about the dogs of war or the pussycats of peace? Well, my members are the pussycats of peace. I mean, let's have less of this nonsense. What do PSCs really do in this day and age? I will argue, that all of the activities that these corporate bodies do can be broken down into one of four categories. And they are as follows. They do outsourced work for the military. They provide the fuel for the fighting machines. They actually fly the UAVs, because it's a bit difficult for the military to fly them. But they do outsourcing for the military, and there's nothing that clever about that. It's just like the National Health Service in the UK contracting out the cleaners. So area of activity number one is outsourcing of military tasks. Second one is that they provide corporate services. They look after the big oil companies. They provide analysis of what's happening in Tajikistan, what the problems are of drilling for oil in the Delta in Nigeria, etc. They have a range of corporate services, some of which involve guns, the majority of which don't. Third one is they support the activities of governments in what is normally called state building. I call it post-conflict reconstruction. So they're there in Iraq, they're there in Afghanistan, supporting the effort, protecting the Bechtels, probably a bad example for this audience, but protecting the people who are rebuilding the schools, whatever they may be called and whatever profit margins they've got. So it's a pretty laudable thing they're doing, and they protect the effort. And then fourthly, they actually engage in nation building, state building themselves. They actually do security sector reform. So on this analysis, all of their activities can fall into those areas. All of those activities may occasionally involve guns. All I'm arguing is that we tend to focus on the unusual rather than the usual. And it's a bit dangerous to start worrying too much about one small area of activity. Of course we should worry about it, don't worry, I'm not going to be that provocative, but it's dangerous to focus on it too carefully at the risk of ignoring what really happens. And you'll notice that the fifth area of activity is the one I didn't mention, and that's invading small African countries. Invading small African countries is wrong. We all know that. It's immoral, and we shouldn't do it. And I tell my members that every week. We're thinking of having a strapline, by the way. I mean, the original strapline was driving up standards, driving out cowboys. And that one goes down fairly well. But I really fancy the one, my members kill for profit. But I thought that's a step too far for some of them. But no, the point I'm making is that reputable companies do not invade small African countries. I do actually know, because they were my bodyguards, some of the people who were on that aeroplane at Harare Airport. I am not defending anything they did at all. What I am saying is that not one of them would ever have read a book like this on international humanitarian law. These people are outside the law, they know they're outside the law, and they wish to be outside the law. That doesn't defend what they're doing, but what it means is one mustn't think that legal means are necessarily going to stop them. So people will always consider invading a country for financial gain, regardless of the state of the law. But that leads me on to the point, which I do believe, and I will argue, that laws are generally useful, they may be necessary, but they're insufficient. What we're actually talking about is control. What we're talking about is an area of activity that we, the public, have valid concerns about, and they are valid, and we are right to be concerned about it. But the objective we're looking for is to control that activity. And law by itself is not enough. So what we argue is, and we're not being the bad guys on this, I think, what we argue and we talk with the ICRC about is what we need is a matrix of activities. And that matrix starts at one level with things like the Geneva Accords. We don't deny them for one second, but it's only a part of the story. The Geneva Accords were written many years ago. In many cases, people don't even understand them properly. So they're part of the story. We're then talking about the whole body of international humanitarian law and international human rights law. It's part of the story, but it's not all of the story, because countries operate in different ways. So we then talk about national regulation, and we've heard about the South African proposed, or the existing South African regulation and the proposed South African regulation. But that's alone. The British government isn't there. These things are difficult. So that's another part of the jigsaw, but not all of it. So that's why I argue that we need two more parts of the jigsaw. One of those parts is self-regulation. That's why I'm not ashamed of doing self-regulation. Self-regulation by itself is not sufficient. I don't claim it is. But it's an essential part of that jigsaw, because the industry, the reputable firms in the industry, are the only ones who can achieve certain things. So one of those two missing bits is self-regulation. And the second set missing bit is transparency and accountability. Because one of the problems that everybody in this room will have with the PSCs is finding out what's going on. If you're talking about food standards regulation, it's pretty easy. You can go down to Tesco's and you'll know what's happening. But knowing what it is these companies do is very, very difficult. And you can't control unless you can observe. So part of our arguments as an association is that we go for maximum transparency. When we put we've got a website, which isn't a very good website yet, but bear with us, and we list all our members on the website. And there was one firm that wanted to join. They haven't joined, but they wanted to, and they were talking to me. They said, well, Andy, we're all in favour of this, and we'll pay you our subscription now, but we don't want anybody to know we're a member. Well, I'm sorry, I said, in that case, you can't be a member. I don't have secret members. We do transparency. And if you're not prepared to admit you exist, if you're not prepared to give your address, even if it is only a postal address, then we don't want to know you. There's obviously something dodgy about you. So in terms of control of the industry, I see this network of activities going all the way from the Geneva Accords through the full body of international humanitarian human rights law, through national regulation, down to self-regulation, but then with that underpinning idea that we need transparency. I've got 2 minutes left and I'll still be 2 minutes early. So what about my organisation? I'm allowed to do a sales pitch. Well, I'm not really, because none of you are about to become my members, are you? Although I live in hope. But no, the British Association of Private Security Companies is part of that self-regulatory framework. And what we are doing now is moving from where we are to where we wish to be. Where are we? At the moment, we are engaged in what I will describe for the academics as passive self-regulation. And what passive self-regulation means is that the companies who belong to us sign up to various codes of conduct, sign up to various charters, and promise on their oath that they will obey these things. But the reason I say that's passive is it's just possible. I may be being too cynical, but it's just possible they're lying and they don't really mean to obey them. And how on earth would I know anyway? So that's what we call passive self-regulation. And I don't want to denigrate its role. Even getting these companies to admit they exist and sign a charter saying they will uphold human rights was a major exercise in its own right. So I'm not saying passive self-regulation was wrong. What I'm saying is it was a step on the way. And what we're now doing is we're moving into another area, a new area, which I will announce tonight for the first time, because I haven't told the British government yet. We're moving into aggressive self-regulation. And aggressive self-regulation means that we will aggressively go out there with these companies to see what it is that they're doing and to make sure that they are upholding those laws, whatever the laws may be, to make sure that there is an investigative capacity so that when something happens, like I think it was on all the blog sites last week, an ambulance crew was shot up in Baghdad, it will mean there's somebody there who can actually investigate it. Because there, Manu and I do actually agree on far more than we disagree. The fact is that under the existing codes in Iraq, forgetting CPA Order 17, the truth is that the Iraqi police do have a duty under the Iraqi Criminal Code to investigate such an incident, even if the PSC would claim immunity from prosecution. But the fact is that the Iraqi police would never ever, at least for the time being, have the ability to carry out that investigation. And what we're doing under aggressive self-regulation is putting that in place. So I submit that the pussycats of peace is the better description, but I'm prepared to be challenged on that one. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Chief Pussycat for Peace. The challenge will come from George Galloway, actually, who thinks of himself as the main pussycat for peace after his exit from Big Brother.
And he's not a member.
He may or may not be a member, but you say he's not a member. Our speakers have been extremely disciplined, and there's a purpose to that. The purpose is to free up space for debate. Now, those of you who have been at LSE, Centre for the Study of Human Rights events, will know before, will know that what we try and do is we try and develop the arguments and discussion through the question and answers. So, thanks to our speakers, we have laid out a menu of issues for us to further examine. The speakers may want to react to what they've heard as well, which they will be free to do, but we won't do it directly, we'll do it indirectly through the questions and answers. What we ask for in the period we have now to develop the themes is that you signal that you want to ask a question or make an intervention, and that if I call you, you wait until the microphone arrives. There are people, our excellent stewards upstairs and downstairs on either side, so we'll get you a microphone fairly quickly. And then you remember not to turn it off, which is another thing you shouldn't do. And you say who you are, and if you feel you'd like to, if it helps, where you're from, what your engagement is. Because it's not inevitably the case that we're all against the private military companies. You never know, Andy. There's a tremendous range of people here, and we want to draw out what perspective people are bringing to the discussion. And then you can make an intervention, or if it's a question and it's directed at one person, please do say to whom it's directed. I'll take a few questions, interventions, and so on, and then we'll come back to the panel. It would be quite helpful if you could be reasonably short. If it looks as though you're not going to be reasonably short, I may ask Andy to deal with you. It's tremendously handy having a private military company pussycat on my left. So I'm just, having said all that, wondering, I have certainly somebody who's expert at catching an early eye. I have another gentleman at the top, and I've got this gentleman in the second row, and this gentleman in the third row, and we'll take you four. And madam, it's you to kick us off.
Hi, my name is Sagarika Chatterjee from FNC Asset Management, and we invest in a number of companies involved in security military industry. And I was very interested to hear from Andy Bear Park this kind of new commitment that you're going to have to aggressive self-regulation. And I just wanted you to clarify, does that mean that as a condition of membership of your association that you'll require companies to commit to independent an independent monitoring mechanism, and that you will also transparently report on what the findings are of that monitoring, so that we as a public and as investors know what kind of risks we're facing and how those are being mitigated by the companies we're investing in?
Thank you for an absolutely good example of the kind of question and intervention we're looking for in every way. Thank you very much. That's directed at one member of the panel, but we're going to take three more. Just across the way, there was somebody just... No, I think it was somebody closer to here, was there? Or was it you, sir? I thought somebody here had their hand up. Yes, sir.
Yeah, my name is Hans-Peter Heinrich. I'm a master's student here at LSE and former ICRC delegate. I also have a question to Andy. It basically goes in the same direction as you heard before. So active self-regulation, so are you also ready to promote the legal charges for people who have been implied with breaches? So not only to report what happened, but also to take legal action if international humanitarian law or human rights have been violated? Because I think this would be the real sign that you're serious what you talk about, because otherwise people will say, yes, you're not really, you don't want to promote the things and bring them forward.
Thank you, Hans. I will draw on our colleagues after Andy's had an opportunity to meet those two points. We had two gentlemen, second and, well, technically third and fourth rows.
Thank you. My name is Russell Armstrong, and I'm a member of the public. my question is to the whole group. To what extent are states responsible for the rise of the private military company in the context of the vacuum that's created by the lack of troops that's being invested by countries, especially in Iraq. I seem to remember conflicts in Kosovo, the Balkans, were well-staffed by formal soldiers, formal military staff. And do you think that private military companies are simply filling a role that the army should be filling themselves? Thank you.
Thank you, Ross, very well. And if you could just put it behind you, because the gentleman pretty well directly behind you now can ask our fourth question. I think it may be on.
I think it's still on, yeah. My name is Jason Wright. I'm from Cambridge University. Two questions, if I may. Firstly, to Emanuela. You mentioned self-regulation and some of the roles that the companies may play themselves, and you talked about training in humanitarian law and development of SOPs and rules of engagement. I wonder if you would be prepared to be engaged in developing that training and indeed possibly to accredit it, and that might be something which you're developing with the British Association of Private Security Companies. My second question, if I may, to the whole panel is to do with the mechanisms of control that Andy spoke about, that being the key issue. The mechanisms of control for private entities, of course, exist in the marketplace in any case, and that is public listing and transparency and accountability, which is achieved through the insight that is required for a public listing. I wonder, Andy, if one of the requirements of your members might be that they are indeed publicly owned companies, not owned by the four directors of the board, but actually submitting to those control mechanisms which already exist in the private sector and the market. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason, very much. We'll take some responses from the panel. I think I'd quite love to say to you, Andy. I'll come to you, and then I'll take the panel, and then there might be something you might want to say briefly by way of what response to what the panel has said. Andy, really, in a sense, all four, indirectly or directly, requiring or inviting response from you.
Okay, if I can, and I can't remember people's names, I apologise for that. I think the logic will be clear. I'm going to do question one, question two, and question four, in a sense, almost together, and then I'll come back to question three, sir. The short, unequivocal answer to the two questions on the balcony is yes, full stop. There's nothing more to be said. The answer is yes. When I talk about aggressive self-regulation, yes, I talk about making reports publicly available. Yes, I mean prosecuting people thereafter, etc. And I said there wasn't going to be a but, and I don't know if I can do this in English grammar. There isn't a but. Didn't think I could. The but is this. The objective is clear. My agreement with you is 100%. The but is we're not going to get there tomorrow. It took me 15 months to get the PSCs, the major PSCs, to move from vaguely talking about having association to agreeing they would have association. To get them to go from, and to, we debated for hours on end the charter of the association. Everybody had a view on what it would be, etc. So to move to aggressive self-regulation, which involves the reports being available to investors, to the public, to human rights bodies, etc., we're going to get there. I mean, I'm quite prepared to give you a commitment now we will get there, but I'm not going to give you a commitment that we'll get there next month or the month after. The process starts, if you like, tonight. It will finish at a certain point. And let me be realistic, that point is 1 or 2 years away, it's not 1 or 2 weeks away. But it is a continuous process. When our new website goes live, this isn't a marketing exercise, when our new website goes live, I think next week, the process will have started, because for the first time, people will be able to see who our members are and know that there is a listed telephone number and a listed email address, namely mine, where if they've got complaints, they can send those complaints to. I may ignore them on day one because I have no capacity to do anything else, but the first time ever they'll be able to do that. Jumping down to the business point, PSCs are businesses. I mean, another way of looking at things today is to say, what happens to the developments of the airline industry in the 1930s or whatever it would be? Being a publicly listed company does involve significantly greater transparency and significantly greater control than being a non-listed company. But I'm not sure under any regulatory regime anywhere in the world, I may be wrong, I'm open to challenge, but I'm not sure I know of any examples where somebody has said that this sector of business activity can only be engaged in by listed publicly listed companies. So I think it's a mechanism that's not actually available to anybody in practical terms. it's a mechanism that's available to the consumers of the service. In other words, the consumers, whoever they may be, may reach a decision at some stage to say, we will only buy these services from publicly listed companies. But I don't think it's a mechanism that can be controlled the other way around. And very briefly, I'm speaking for too long now, I know, on the question of the state responsibility, it just seems to me absolutely straightforward. The peace dividend was supposed to come with the end of the Cold War. It didn't come. But we all know that militaries are downsizing. Governments wish to spend less money on militaries in various ways. The only serious point I'd make there is that we should all remember that that wasn't a decision of the PSCs. The PSCs never went along and said, we want to do this. It was the governments, not even the militaries, it was the government of the United States, the government of the United Kingdom, and I'd submit an awful lot more governments, who said, we are going to outsource to the private sector. So I view my responsibility as being not to affect that decision. That decision was taken down the road in Parliament. I view my responsibility as being to say, if that's what you're doing, how can you now do it effectively, rationally, sensibly, etc.?
Thanks, Andy. I'm going to ask Chiloka now both to deal with the questions directed at him and also if he chooses to reflect on what he's heard since he sat down some 40 or so minutes ago. Chiloka.
Thank you very much, Connor. reflections essentially on two questions. One about state responsibility for the rise of PMCs and downsizing of the military. I think it raises important questions about the public role of the state and its public functions.
Thank you for pointing that out.
I was just beginning to say that the question raises important issues about the public role of the state and its public functions, and whether aspects of military operations and the capacity of the state to actually carry out military activities is one that the state can privatize. And I organized with that question for some time when I started looking in this area. It seemed that states, in order to cut down on their costs, clearly decided to downsize their militaries and have a lean, efficient military force. Now, whether that works well or not is another matter. But that had two consequences. One is that, obviously, private military companies got involved in security sector reform. The other is that those persons who had been demobilized from the military had to find ways of selling their services on the market. And mercenaries had obviously become unfashionable, but private military companies were obviously the avenue. The third consequence is that states are also having to suffer as a result of this. I think almost all the states now involved in Iraq, including South Africa, is having to experience a hemorrhage of members of its armed forces, leaving the armed forces in order to serve in private military companies because of the fact that the pay is considerably higher. So South Africa's penalties may be $3,000 for a person who deserts, but they make $6,000 per day in Iraq, so you know that's peanuts. But I think that when push comes to shove, it is really about the role of the state, how we perceive it, and what the public functions of the state are. And in my own view, the state is clearly responsible for maintaining peace. It's clearly responsible for military operations, and I would rather private military companies operated the traditional role that they always operated, i.e. provide logistical support, surveillance, and other forms of assistance to the armed forces. I think the US has always had a practice traditionally of incorporating private military companies into its armed forces if they are to be involved in any sense that is actually combat related. I do favor that model. There's the question of control and mechanisms, and whether or not they should be publicly owned. I think the major aspect of control for me goes to the board, i.e. the board of directors of the company. And in this regard, although Andy did say that law is useful but not that useful, and that what is required is control, I would say that the law has to provide a framework for effective control, because without a legal basis for that, the nature of control that we're seeking is neither here nor there. And because it's a private military company, I've argued before that it's important to have a command structure within the company, at the very heart of the company, in the nature of the board itself, which means that the legislation has to say something about the composition of the board and the responsibility of the board for the operations of the company. And I also think that knowledge of international humanitarian law and knowledge of human rights law is also important, because what may count as the most repressive method of putting down an insurrection somewhere might also be a serious breach of human rights law in terms of torture, inhuman degrading treatment, and deprivation of the right to life and other aspects. The difficult, however, is that the companies tend to mutate. The more rigid a system is in one country, the more they incorporate themselves elsewhere, where they think that there's flexibility and they can actually, you know, get away with this. And the same applies to the countries where they operate. Others suggest tripartite contractual frameworks between the company, the country of origin, and the country of operation. And again, I do not think that such important matters should actually be relegated to contractual frameworks. I think it's very important because of state responsibility and other issues that in such contracts are a product of a legislative framework which is solidly anchored, reflecting fundamental principles of international law, human rights, as well as international humanitarian law.
And Emmanuel, there obviously was a point about training, but feel free to roam briskly but freely.
Thank you. Yes, I was going to address one dimension of the question from my former colleague. You asked Andy if they were to discover violations, would they bring legal proceedings, would they commence proceedings? Well, Andy answered that in part, but the reality is that it's not for a company to initiate proceedings. The prosecutor has got to do that. So we've got to unpack the possible role of the company with that of the prosecuting authorities. And this is something that we've been discussing with the company, and it's about establishing a mechanism for investigating alleged violations and then doing something about the findings of them, because the reality is that often the persons suspected of misconducts are dismissed, and that's the end of the responsibility of the company. It says, well, that's it, they don't work for us anymore. And what we insist upon is, no, don't do that, carry out a proper investigation, and then transmit the results of the investigation to the proper investigative authorities. And in fact, to come to to one of the questions that was put about the role of a publicly owned company, this whistleblowing on oneself procedure was in fact mentioned to us by a publicly owned company, saying, we have now become publicly owned and we need to be much more careful about what we do, because there's a lot more transparency and the public is looking at issues such as this. What do we do in cases of alleged violations by our staff? With regard to your very specific question about the possible role of the ICRC in training and accreditation, it is something that a number of companies have come to us in with regard to specific advice, either on IHL, on their codes of ethics, on their codes of conduct, and also with regard to training. The first part of the answer is we're very careful not to assist a single specific company, because it can be all too easily manipulated and they can say, oh, the ICRC has assisted us in our training, we are by far the best company. So we're always very careful to go, whenever possible, through industry associations. So that's why we've established a good relationship with Andy, because that gives establishes a level playing field for all the companies. Unfortunately, at present, there's only an association here in the UK and another association in the US. So it's not in relation to all contexts when we can do that. We have engaged in a discussion with the British company as to the type of assistance that the ICRC could provide across the board in terms of training, in terms of general advice. At one point, the issue of some form of ICRC-accredited course came up, and we steered away from that because it's just something we do not do. We don't do it for armed forces, we don't do it for rebel groups, so you're never going to have an ICRC-accredited course with an ICRC report card at the end of it. But we still want to engage constructively and provide advice, and in fact the companies came to us for suggestions as to, for example, the 12 commandments, something very simple that can be given to their staff in the field, what you can do, what you can't do, as well as a much more detailed policy document as to what we view their responsibilities as being.
Thanks. Would 12 commandments work with those guys who are bodyguarding you that were found in Harare?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose just when they're about to fire the trigger. But no, the answer is yes, they would work, because most people do not actually want to break these laws. Most people do want to do the right things, but what they want is the information in a way they can actually understand it. So the direct parallel is those little cards that the British military are given telling what their rules of engagement are. Most PSC operatives would love to know exactly what their rules of engagement are.
I have three gentlemen who've already caught my eye. I've now got four, five, six gentlemen. I'm wondering whether or not this is a boy's subject. I have a lady, very good. And have I got anybody? I've got two. So I've got four more. I've got this gentleman who caught my eye, and actually we have this lady, and then we will go up front, and you. So very quickly, because we already have four with lots of hands up. Sorry, I'll take you a little bit later on. They're all downstairs, so we'll come up for the next round. Sir.
Sebastian Rutschmann, King's College London. Two questions. First one is probably more a remark. I mean, one great military thinker of contemporary times said, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you want. I mean, maybe the same applies for the enforcement structures we have. Mr. Bignani, you said that contractual law is not the best place to regulate humanitarian law. Ideally, I agree. Right now, it might be just the best thing we have, because corporations tend to respect the contract. And I would suggest maybe you can think a bit about what kind of ways we can use contracts to enforce law. The second question goes primarily to Mr. Bierpark. In military, there are two ways when you're under fire. Either you return fire or you dig a foxhole and make yourself as comfortable as possible. The question I have is the kind of pressure private security companies, especially in Great Britain and the US, have come under, especially a couple of years ago when there was a lot of negative press. What was your kind of perception? Was it useful to develop a regulatory system, an industry authority, or was it rather hindering the process? Thank you very much.
Thank you for very specific two colleagues on the platform. The lady who caught my eye, yes, thank you.
Hello, my name is Petra. I'm working with Radar IHE, and I have a small comment to make, or a remark to what Emanuela said before in regards to training. The organization I'm working with is an NGO, and we mainly offer training to other NGOs. And one increasing sector for us is security, that NGOs ask us to provide security training. And what we realize that we draw a lot of former military staff into these training services. So we have a number of trainers who have that experience. And we started to design a course or a new workshop, which we call a transfer of skills workshop, which probably is a bit what both you, Emanuela, and also Andy mentioned a bit, the point of transferring the skills that are very helpful and necessary from a military perspective into the humanitarian sector and into the perspective of human rights and humanitarian law.
Thank you, Petra. And there's a gentleman who caught my eye much earlier, just behind you, whose hand is now up. Thank you, sir.
Mike Navrinsky from the Royal College of Defence Studies. In 2002, the UK government did publish a green paper seeking to regulate private military companies, and lots of discussion has carried on since then, which probably reflects the difficulties that surround the topic. But I seek the panel's view really on one of the options which seems to have caught their eye recently in terms of expanding the current legislation which seeks to license the export of weapons in the UK. Do the panel think that this is a good template? Would it work? Or is it just too big a topic for a UK government to take on? Should it be something like the United Nations that takes this forward? Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. And if we can hurtle down here, we're overworking this, Stuart. Disproportionately paid, I hope. Madam.
Okay, my name is Sarah with Brussels Tribunal. How many security companies, British security companies, are working in Iraq? How many people does this comprise? Is it possible that the private security companies will take the place of the present occupation, both British and American, in America, so that they can go home, the soldiers can go home, but you will run their business for them?
Thanks, Sarah, particularly in light of today's news about possible earlier than expected troop withdrawals. Andy.
Okay, doing the last one first because it's freshly in my mind. Numbers, first of all. The estimate of the number of PSC operatives in Iraq varies, A, over time, but B, depending on who's asking the question, between 10,000 and 25,000. And it is impossible to be nobody knows is the answer, because no register is kept. So those are the two extreme estimates you'll hear. I would guess at the moment that if you're talking about British staff, you're certainly talking about no more than, say, 5,000, in other words, half of that 10,000. So again, nobody can prove the figures, but I would argue my guess is probably better than most. If you're asking about companies, then British companies operating in Iraq, you can actually get a fairly definitive answer from the website of the Private Security Company Association of Iraq. And I think they, at the last count, were listing about 25 British companies. Again, estimates do vary. The two extreme estimates I've heard are 20 and 35. The reason in this case for the wide variation is because you have what are called single contract companies, which are essentially just groups of people who've got one contract and they've read a book somewhere that says they'll pay less tax if they're a company, and so they've just created a shell company for that one particular contract. If you're looking at, I don't want to use the word reputable, but if you're looking at established companies, there are something like 14 British companies operating in Iraq. So that's the variation. But in terms of your policy question at the end, I mean, I think the answer is no, no, and no again. The British military are there as an arm of the British government, as part of what was an occupying force and is now a force that is there at the request of the Iraqi government, however hollow one's laughter may be. But I cannot see how that could ever be replaced by a private sector force at this stage. It could happen one day. I would think it inconceivable it could happen in Iraq. That's to do with the Blackwater arguments about could they do Darfur better than the United Nations. Maybe they could, but it's a step too far for the time being. So no, there will be some activities that PSCs will increase as the British militaries go, but there will also be a lot of other things they cease doing, because they won't want to be there without the overall protective umbrella of the occupying power. On the question about the publicity on PSCs, it's worth coming back to the concept. We all like focusing on these attractive, that's a rather sick word, but attractive sort of images of men with guns. For this concept, I prefer just to go back to the idea that PSCs are businesses. That's all they are. They're businesses that try and make money. Therefore, they obey the normal rules of businesses. So, yes, the publicity that took place a while ago, I don't know which one you're referring to, whether it's back to the Abu Ghraib days or whether it's the Aegis videos or whatever, but publicity like that creates a commercial incentive to distinguish yourself as a quality provider. So publicity like that in the press does, it increases my membership. You know, more people come along and say, I want to join and be inside of the good boys rather than the bad boys. Gentleman at the back asking about the British Green Paper. The brutal but accurate description is that it's currently filed in the too difficult tray. And I know of no usable model anywhere at the moment. There's a lot of debate to be gone through. The devil is in the detail with regulation like that, because we are, as somebody pointed out, dealing with companies who can relocate instantly. What is a British company, etc., etc.? So I would submit, and the two lawyer colleagues might argue with me, I would submit that nobody's got it right. And the reason I say that is that even the South African government admits that its existing legislation is virtually useless. They haven't been able to get a single successful prosecution under it. So I was in fact in Cape Town yesterday giving evidence to the South African Parliament on their proposed new legislation, which, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of other people are concerned, is equally flawed in other directions. So at the moment there are no good models of national legislation out there.
Thanks, Andy, for that. Chinoka and Emmanuel.
Okay, with the
hope that we get some more in. So.
Yeah. I think I have one direct response, which is about thinking carefully in the way in which contracts may be used to enforce law. And I've actually thought very carefully about this, and I've looked at models where states contract with private corporations, and these contracts entail restricted immunity on the part of states, but they're also well-established fora and processes by which, in the event of a dispute, the contract would either be enforced or interpreted, as the case might be. In the context of private military companies, what you'd have, in essence, is a tripartite contractual arrangement between the country in which the company is based, the country in which the operations or services are to be offered, as well as the company itself. At once, obviously, that begs the law of the forum applicable to the contract and where the contract might be litigated, where the whole issue of litigation in the event of breach might arise. You're also dealing with governments in some respects that are actually unable to sustain themselves economically and otherwise. So there may be further problems. But I think that the biggest problem is that this is an issue that goes beyond damages, because state responsibility cannot be contracted out on the basis of a private contractual arrangement, which is the biggest problem that such contracts would have from the point of view of public international law. That were the company to breach certain aspects of international law which engages the responsibility of the state, then obviously, you know, the contract would have some clauses about how that responsibility would be engaged. And I think that's the most difficult issue that the contractual arrangement model poses. As for export control arms, I think the model is actually derived from the United States, which is what the United States operates. It operates a licensing system, vets the companies very carefully, and determines which company will be given a license to export arms. And there's oversight both from the point of view of Senate as well as the House of Representatives on those issues. So democratic oversight does apply. And I'm not entirely convinced that the Green Paper is actually dead, because I've had some minimum contact from the Foreign Office on this issue. And I think that there may be some attempts to have a white paper, or some thinking is going on behind the scenes anyway regarding what ought to be done. And I do agree that no model that exists as of now is actually quite effective, because of the nature of the industry and the nature of the companies involved, in the sense that they're corporate structures and, you know, they can exist anywhere. And one company can also exist in several countries and several jurisdictions, and that too is an issue. Thank you.
And Emmanuel.
Thank you. I think the gentleman at the back asked me a question about the Swiss initiative. he did. But just
I completely
to go to
forgot
the
about the Swiss initiative. But
I didn't.
You have a minute or two, but you'll have a sum up.
Okay.
It, but
just very briefly with regard to the possible role of arms export legislation, as Chaloka said, that is exactly where some states, and I'm thinking principally the US, but also possibly Israel, have found a home for the export of security services abroad. I'm not familiar with the British system, and I agree with Andrew that the devil is in the detail with all of this. But yes, definitely as a blueprint, yes, it could be a possible way of looking at it. Off the top of my head, I seem to think that there's some criteria for determining the instances in which weapons can be transferred. So similarly, you could have a series of criteria for determining when services can be provided, when they can't. It would have to be tweaked, because there may be certain activities that could never be carried out, for example, direct participation in hostilities. There may be certain additions that are necessary, in particular, definitely from an ICRC point of view, something about IHL and training. So it is a possibility. Devil in the detail, who would be the body responsible for issuing these licenses? Could it be the same one as with arms exports? How do you oversee the overseas implementation of this? Because with regard to weapons, you have an end-user certificate, not quite the same with regard to the provision of services. Just the UK, well, I think, again, that's one of the challenges because of the mobility of these companies. If the UK regulates too tightly, they'll just go abroad. What about the EU? The EU has a non-binding code of exports, code of conduct on arms exports, so that could possibly be expanded so that we have a level playing field across Europe. That's a possibility, but they definitely haven't got round to thinking about it yet. What about the UN? Well, this takes me to the Swiss Intergovernmental Initiative. Not because Switzerland is a member of the UN now, but just because the Swiss Ministry of Foreign Affairs, as depositaries of the Geneva Conventions, wanted to address the phenomenon of PSCs, to try and promote respect for international humanitarian law. And they want to bring together a number of states. The process is still unclear because we're at early stages yet, to try and adopt some form of end product, some soft law instrument. We're not talking treaty, which would enhance respect for international humanitarian law and human rights law. We're thinking as to the possible form it could take, and it would be a rather simple first part, reaffirming the existing law in terms of responsibility, status, obligations, not so complex. Much more interesting would be the second part, where the idea is to develop a series of blueprints, templates, possible national legislation to be adopted by states, either the states where the companies are incorporated, so for example, the UK, to regulate the industry operating abroad, or also a second template would be relevant to the state where the companies are operating. As I said, currently only Syria and Leone and Iraq that have something akin, that have any form of regulation for companies operating there. And then the third dimension would be best practices when a state itself hires a private company. It would be a soft law instrument. We're not trying to negotiate a treaty, but it could then provide guidance, and we're thinking that it would be most appropriate at the regional level. So it could be fed into the EU process. It could be fed into, for example, the OSCE, the AU. The reality is different regions are going to take different approaches to particular elements, but that's what we're thinking of now. We've had a first small meeting in January, and there's going to be a broader consultation with states towards the end of November.
It's fascinating, and thank you for saying that. I'm going to squeeze in, the gentleman right in the back has been trying to catch my eye the whole time. This lady here is coming in, and we'll see how quickly. I know, sirs, there'll be lots of opportunities to follow up in the reception, but we do want to finish soon. Let's see how quick and efficient these interventions are. Sir.
My name is Ilias Bantekas from the University of Westminster. Two very slight points, one for Chaloka. I fail to see how the prohibition of mercenaries is reconciled with the right of self-determination, and that is for internal and external self-determination. When you have a small group of people who are fighting against colonial domination, for example, then they would have the right to hire a firm or mercenaries to help them. Bosnia said the same as well during the conflict. They need to have the right of self-determination and the right of self-defense, and I can't see how these are reconciled. And lastly, Manuela, you said that only states can hire combatants, but that's not true with regard, because guerrillas can do the same as well, under guerrillas can be combatants under Article 4 of Geneva 3.
Right, I take that as directed at Chaloka. Thank you very much. Madam, I'm going to take this lady up here, just in the front row, and we'll try and squeeze in one of you guys as well. Yeah. Please.
My name is Sachiko Kitahara from King's College, and I'd like to ask about the relationship between private security companies and UN peacekeeping operations, which I've heard that these private companies are already involved in certain extent, and these missions can be attractive than invading small African states, and also if there are any additional legal, I'd like to hear about the comment if there are any other additional legal problem which caused by hiring those private media companies by United Nations.
Thank you. And this lady here, very quickly if you will, because we're hitting up to our deadline.
Thank you very much. My name is Anthea Lawson. I work for the International Action Network on Small Arms, which is a global coalition of civil society organisations campaigning for controls in the arms trade. So my question is for Emanuela, and it's about arms transfers. Given that there's a growing recognition of states' responsibilities under international humanitarian law for controlling arms transfers so that weapons are not exported to places where they can be used to violate human rights, how does this apply, in your view, to private military companies, given that they play quite a role in arms brokering and the transfer of weapons?
Thank you for the succinctness of that. Two chaps right beside each other. Have you fought it out and decided which of you is allowed to ask a question? Because only one of you is, and it has to be incredibly short, and you can't share it. And this is our last one.
Hi, I'm just a master's student here, but I just wanted to ask, Dr. Bayani and Andy Park, or Bear Park, seem to be talking about completely different definitions. One seems to be talking about private military corporations, which by definition, according to some academics, are dead, because all they do are engage in offensive operations. And Mr. Bear Park talks about companies that engage in security actions, protecting workers, and help reconstruct nations. Is this fact that these two seem to be arguing without really engaging in a debate about a definition create this gap in law and allow them to kind of weave in between and create the loophole?
Well, thank you, Justin. I'm a C student at LSE. It's excellent. Well worth having. I'm going to ask our speakers to be very disciplined, but to answer, you know, not to be so quick that they don't answer. Because some of the points raised in this last round have been excellent and very pointed. I think maybe we start with Chaloka, and then perhaps Andy, and then if we end with you, Emanuela, and Chaloka.
I do agree entirely that mercenaries and self-determination are linked, and it's no accident that the whole question of mercenaries arose in 1960 in the Congo, right at the time when the General Assembly Resolution 1560 on self-determination was actually issued. But both sides of the coin are important, which is that mercenaries may be a means of suppressing self-determination, i.e. repressing the popular will of the people by a government that actually can't win a war, and therefore resorts to recruiting mercenaries. On the other hand, you might also have a government democratically elected, which essentially reflects the will of the people, but somehow mercenaries are hired to destabilize it. I think what I took issue was simply the fact that the offense of mercenarism in the African Convention is tied with the issue of self-determination. And when you look at that definition in the convention, you'd actually have to define the elements of the crime in the context of self-determination, which is not easy. I don't expect that there'll be any conviction out of that. The point about UN peacekeeping operations, certainly major peacekeeping operations of the UN have been supported by private military companies, and especially in Sierra Leone, Liberia, Cote d'Ivoire, the DRC as now we speak, as well as the UN mission in Ethiopia and Eritrea, in terms of logistics, demining, those kinds of activities are supported by private military companies. As the terminology private military companies or private military corporations, I think the point is just the same. The major distinctions between private military companies and private security companies, those two are fairly distinct. From the point of view of the objectives and what they do. But the point is that whether they're private military companies or private military, private security companies or private military corporations, they all have one mode of legal existence, which is that they're legally incorporated as bodies with legal personality under domestic law. And I think that might explain why there's been a crossover between the terminology.
Thank you, Andy.
I don't think the terminology actually causes any problem in terms of the debate. There are difficulties with the definitions, and there are cultural differences as well. Quite simply, the Americans are happy to see themselves described as PMCs. A British company undertaking exactly the same activity would prefer to be described as a PSC. But this is essentially a public relations point. When it comes to the debate about the law and what should apply, I don't see a problem. Under the definitions I was giving earlier on, I simply consider PMCs to be a subset of PSCs. But I don't think that creates a legal distinction. As far as the UN operations are concerned, the only point I'd add is that in the probably 5 years ago, quite a few people would have argued for an increased role for the PSCs in UN peacekeeping operations. I may still be tempted to do so, or at least my members might, but a number of very distinguished commentators in the last few months have pointed out that the world has actually moved on a lot, and that organisations like the African Union are now able to do a lot of things that they weren't 5 years ago, that there has been a big change in practical capacity. Not in logistical capacity, there will always be a role for the support operation, but in terms of the spearhead operation, if you like, the arguments that would have applied 5 years ago don't apply now. And to use a final 10 seconds for my colleague, I didn't say the Green Paper was dead, I said it was dormant, but we can debate that later on.
The pussy cat bites back. Emmanuel, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Very briefly, with regard to the peacekeeping question, I agree that with what's been said, and it's also, if you speak to DBKO, they tend to say that they are unlikely to contract out anything more than the existing support, logistical support dimension. I think it's interesting, we've all had our eye on the ball of peacekeeping operations. Well, the reality is that now these companies are beginning to realize that there is a market for provision of humanitarian assistance, and are now beginning to go that direction rather than in peacekeeping. So perhaps that's where we should be looking at, which alters the relationship of the ICRC with this new actors significantly, because we're now much more concerned about preserving our separate identity. With regard to the question from Jansa, your very specific question about what has the ICRC been doing in relation to PMCs that are involved in arms brokering, quite frankly, we haven't got there yet. I think it's something very important and something that needs to be addressed in any regulatory framework when we define the type of activities that would be covered. Yes, the support, the logistic dimension, the direct participation in hostilities, but let's not also forget this very important dimension of it, which can have an impact on the realization of human rights and a respect for international humanitarian law. I don't know how closely you've been following the discussion on the arms trade treaty that Jansa has been promoting, but definitely that is one of the models that we're looking at when we're speaking about possible national regulatory frameworks. that's a different question, but definitely with regard to brokering, it would be in the context of definition of activities, and to just chip in the discussion about what shall we call these companies. Quite frankly, the ICRC is trying to use the term private military, private security companies, because the name of the company doesn't really matter. The reality is that many companies provide a whole spectrum of activities, and instead we have been focusing on the activities per se rather than the label that a particular company uses.
Thank you very much. Now, there's something worth saying, which is that NSE started this international humanitarian law project. Louise is here, is responsible for it. And so there's, the Centre's not doing any more on this this year, but there's a big talk by Professor Sir Adam Roberts, a super guy from Oxford, on what, Louise? Is it terrorism and human rights or something? Pardon? Occupation. And that's here on the 5th of June. So what, and I appear to be chairing it. So we may be ending for the season, but there is this date in your diary here, the 5th of June, in this room with a leading expert carrying the debate forward with this new exciting project at NSE. This is the end for the centre for the academic year for these things. We'll be back in the autumn. I have to say that there's an astonishing deal, which I regret to say isn't my book outside. The astonishing deal is this enormous book, Customary International Humanitarian Law, Volume 1, which is astonishingly cheap at £16.80. For £16.80, you get hundreds and hundreds of pages, which is quite extraordinary. For, I thought, a cheap price, but now I can see it's very expensive. For £11 or something, you get a very few pages. And it's, I am afraid, even larger typescript. But it's up to you. They're both available for sale. And we would be delighted mainly, however, they're available for sale just outside, but we'd be delighted mainly to invite you to continue the discussion for drinks. You have acquitted yourself as an audience with brilliant questions and observations, as you always do. And what happens now, if you haven't been to our centre discussions before, is the debate continues over a glass of wine. Before I tell you where it's on, or just before I tell you, I'd like to say a huge thank you, and in telling you that it's on the 5th floor in the senior dining room, before you burst out in the direction of the two lifts that we have at LSE to get there first, having bought the books, I'd like you to recognise the role the International Committee of the Red Cross has. This is a fantastic partnership we have with them. This is the 5th year we've done this, the 4th year I've been here. Each one has been a cutting edge issue. They do a heck of a lot of the organisation. Obviously Joy White and the team do a lot at the centre, but we have a great relationship with the ICRC. Roland has been a tremendous stalwart for the organisation. Emmanuel has been a number of times. We are very, very grateful for the support they show for this event. But we're especially grateful to our three speakers, Mr. Gilligan in his bedsit wondering what he's going to do tomorrow. We send him our condolences because he missed a super evening. And can you, en route to purchase books and go up to the 5th floor, find the time to give them a tremendous round of applause. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.